So he's a Presbyterian minister and a U.S. Army chaplain.
The crucifixion that Jesus, peace be upon him, who we love, is one of the...
Be confirmed as a member of the Presbyterian Church to take my first communion. For the first time, I found myself making salah as if I were a Muslim. So, and he looked at me kind of incredulously. You mean you're not Muslim? I said, no, sir. Well, what are you? Well, you know, I had the rap down. You know, I'm probably more like an agnostic pagan Buddhist. And he said, mashallah, you're in the perfect place.
The Dean Show.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Assalamu alaikum. Greetings of peace. Welcome to the Dean Show. I'm Eddie, your host. Subscribe if you haven't already and continue to tune in here every week. We have an exciting guest, exciting episode. We're not just telling stories. We're inspiring people. We're helping to change lives through these stories. Now, my next guest coming on, his father was a Christian minister. He turned towards being an agnostic. And then he considered himself a pagan Buddhist. And the list goes on of things that he's tried. We're going to go ahead and bring him on so he can share his story and then how he ended up here on the Dean Show with my next guest. Don't go anywhere. Go ahead and subscribe right now. Hit that notification bell. Help us get our numbers back up. Did you know that many years ago, the Dean Show, when we started 2006, we used to broadcast for many years on the Khalifa Clothing Channel, currently known as Digital Minbar. So we're trying to get our numbers back up because the channel at that time got closed. Then we started the official Dean Show channel. We're trying to get our numbers back up to where they should be. And that's this number here, 855, combined what we currently have, 442. We should be over 1,200,000 subscribers. Help us to get our numbers back to where they should be. With that small setback that we had many years ago, you guys can help us by subscribing right now and hitting that notification bell. Thank you very much. Enjoy the rest of the show. Assalamu alaikum. And don't forget to support us on our Patreon page. Assalamu alaikum. How you doing, Hugh Esco?
Wa alaikum salam. Good to be here. Thanks for the invitation, Eddie.
Thank you for accepting that invitation. It's quite new. You accepted Islam maybe, 2016? Is that right?
Something like that.
Okay, So tell us now, let's start with the beginning. So I started off with your father being a Christian minister. Let's go from there.
So he's a Presbyterian minister and a U.S. Army chaplain. You know, whether it was bringing the war home with him or he did two tours in Vietnam, part of the U.S. occupation of that sovereign nation. Or, you know, maybe he just picked up these bad habits as a kid, but, you know, he sexually abused and physically abused me and my siblings. And, you know, when the time came for me to be confirmed as a member of the Presbyterian Church to take my first communion, you know, just, I didn't feel it. Didn't add up back then. You know, I didn't understand concepts like spiritual abuse and, you know, all of that back then. I just knew that the stories they were telling us in catechism class didn't really jive with how he was in the world. And so I wasn't feeling it. Apparently, I broke my grandmother's heart. She cried that day. So for probably 12 or 15 years, I called myself agnostic after that.
Well, let's back it up from there. Someone says, look, it's not about feeling the truth or experience it. The truth is the truth. It doesn't matter what kind of... Yeah, the person goes through, and it's really sad to hear these experiences that people go through because of human beings' deficiencies and the evil of human beings, the evil that human beings do. But now the truth is the truth. So if someone asks you, well, hold on, that was your experience, other people that have experience, you know, why didn't you accept this as the truth, this way of life that your father was upon in preaching, even though he was a bad example of it?
And, you know, that was my experience of what being a part of the Presbyterian faith, you know, was supposed to look like, that you abuse your children, you know, and I had, you know, long before I was being asked to take a first communion, you know, it was clear that I was never going to hit any child of mine. You know, I knew enough that didn't strike me as an appropriate way to be in the world. And you know, I didn't have any real examples of, you know, what it was to be in a faith community where people were respectful of each other, or at least respectful of me. I'm told, you know, as with many abusive men, that he put on a good show in public. No one knew what happened in our home. That was back in the day when that was all private and behind scenes and didn't talk about it. And it was even legal in most states of this country.
What was legal?
To abuse your children in these ways, to mm-hmm. abuse the woman you were married to in these ways, you know? And so, you know, I came by.
It was when you say legal.
It wasn't a matter of public concern. It wasn't a criminal matter. It was a private matter. It was, you know, men's violence has often been shielded by, you know, what happens in the family stays in the family. And we don't have to, you know, concern ourselves. That's someone else's private affair.
What about the theology and the teachings? For instance, many people would gravitate them towards Islam is the pure monotheism, you know, the simple message of being morally upright, the Quran, all the evidence that it's based mm-hmm. on. Mm-hmm. So here with the theology of Christianity, before we go into agnosticism, what was it? Did it connect with you? I mean, how much did you know about the teachings, the Trinity, Jesus, peace be upon him, dying for your sins, the crucifixion? What were your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, that Trinity piece never really added up for me, honestly. And so, coming to a community where people weren't trying to pretend that God was begatting himself, you know, cleared up some of that confusion. And, you know, I had been hearing the stories, and I continued to hear the stories. Church service was compulsory until I was pretty much in junior college. Sunday school was compulsory almost as long. And so I was exposed to the stories ongoingly, but, you know, it just didn't, it was something I had to do on Sunday in order to avoid a whipping. It wasn't something that I, you know, that's not really I was really taken by, is it in Al-Baqarah, I believe, you know, that there's no compulsion in matters of faith.
Are you talking about in the Quran, the ayah?
In the Quran, yeah.
Al-Fidin. Okay, no.
I don't remember exactly where. I got this census in the second surah. But, you know, the idea that, you know, and politically I've long counted myself as something of an anarchist. And so the idea that I'd be coming into a faith community where there was no compulsion, you know, that you either choose to come into this community and be a part of it, or you don't. You know, that had an appeal. But yeah.
What drove you towards now? Just one more before we go to the next, the crucifixion that Jesus, peace be upon him, who we love, is one of the mightiest messengers. You know, Muslim, he's a Muslim unless he believes and loves Jesus.
Right.
Now that he died for your sins. The crucifixion. What were your thoughts on that?
You know, I really didn't focus on, you know, as a kid, you know, what are my sins? I was late coming in for dinner. You know, it was, you know, I wasn't out there, you know, in terms of the commandments, I wasn't killing people. I wasn't stealing from people, you know, it's so the idea that someone had died for my sins, it was another story that people were telling me. And, mm-hmm. you know, it was, I endured the compulsory, nature of going to church every Sunday. And, you know, I came home and picked up a novel and went on with my life.
So at what point in the timeline now did you decide to label yourself an agnostic? And define for our audience who've never heard this term, what does it mean to label yourself an agnostic?
Well, in my mind, it kind of means that understanding the nature of the Creator and of their design for the creation is above my pay grade. It's not something that I'm really capable of saying definitively one way or another. And, you know, I reach for that label because when people came to be aware that I had not confirmed my faith in the Presbyterian Church, had not, you know, held up my hand or whatever and swore to the trilogy and to the, what do they call it? There was this, the creed. There's this.
The catechism? Creed.
There's a particular creed. They call it the Bloody Synod. And in the early Christian church, they brought the bishops together, and apparently they were met with people with swords who insisted that they sign this document that was blank. We're going to figure out what we all agree on, but you know, you, in order to not be killed on your way through the door, you have to sign this document saying that you've already agreed to what we're about to talk about. And that was, you know, when you read the history of the Nicene Creed, they call it. It was the Council of Nicaea that formulated this, and in the history books they call it the Bloody Synod. And you know that basically to take the First Communion, you're asked to affirm your faith in, you know, Jesus as a path to what I now understand as Jenna, and to say that you frame your faith around this Nicene Creed. I didn't know the history of the Council of Nicaea back then, except, you know, the story that had been told in the communion class or the catechism class. But I knew that Trinity thing, you know, I couldn't wrap my head around that at 12 or 13 or years of age, whatever, however old I was back then. So,
in comparing notes with other people about the Trinity, like, did you ask some of your friends? Were you seeing the same pattern of people just not being able to make it fit?
It wasn't my priority. Mm-hmm. It was my parents' priority. It wasn't my priority.
Yeah. You got other things going on at that age, huh?
Yeah. You know, whatever it was I was interested in at 13 years of age, I don't remember. That was 40 years ago, 45 years ago or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, people said, well, if you're not a Christian, what are you? And so I had to figure out, you know, an answer to that. And so I had to do a little research and you know, okay, and I'm not Jew and I'm not Hindu and I'm not Buddhist and I'm not this and I'm not that. And, you know, I'm not an atheist. I'm not going to tell people that I don't believe that there's a God because, you know, that question's above my pay grade. Who knows? You know, I'm 13 years old. Give me a break. Let me figure out other things. Maybe I'll figure that out later or not. You know, it wasn't a priority. So I clicked on this word agnostic, which basically means that I don't know. I'm not going to tell you that I know something that I don't know. And it seemed like the most honest way to describe myself. And that got me past this conversation and this question for, you know, a 10 or a dozen years. Mm-hmm. You know, and then... Yeah.
And then we move on to timeline, and then you become a Buddhist?
Well, that was later. I was a political organizer by the time I was in my late 20s. And doing community organizing, I wound up being invited into this community known as the Rainbow Family of Living Light. And they hold these gatherings in the forest. And, you know, it's some of it is New Age hoo-hoo, and some of it is you know, some sincere efforts to connect with our our kind of primal history of being indigenous people, indigenous to this planet, being in relationship with the creation. And it, you know, there were all sorts of faith traditions that were interwoven in the rainbow community, including a lot of people who identified as Christian, of course, but others who identified in various earth-based faiths, generally known as pagan faiths, about that our relationship is not so much with the creator, but with the creation itself. And as an environmental activist, that felt really comfortable to me. And so, you know, we would gather in circles for the new moon and the full moon, and we would gather in circles and share potluck meals around solstice and the equinox, and you know, but like all faith communities, it provides a sense of community, a place to come together, a place to share rituals, a place to connect with one another in the understanding that, you know, there's something bigger than our own personal experience that's going on here in the world.
But now that you look back, were these, you mentioned the solstice, you mentioned some other things, were these, when you unfolded them, these are kind of like pagan rituals?
They are traditionally pagan rituals, but you know what I noticed when I started keeping the five prayers was that I had never been more in touch with those changing seasons than I was when I was keeping track of when the next Adon was going to be sounded.
Wow.
You know, because just like the pagan community in which Islam was given, you know, the Islamic calendar is a lunar calendar, and the rituals of Islam are geared around the movement of the earth in relationship to the sun and the changing of the seasons. And, you know, so I was able to, and of course, my first fast was right across the summer solstice, the longest day of the year. And I had known that as a pagan, that was the longest day of the year. And so I figured, you know, if I could make it through a fast that included the solstice, then, you know, 20 or 30 years from now, you know, inshallah, that I have the opportunity to live that long, that, you know, when the fast occurred during the winter, it'd be easier, and, you know, it would never get any more. I would be lucky to live long enough for the fast to overlap with the summer solstice. And, you know, I don't know how they do it up in Lapland where the days are 18 and 19 and 20 hours long, you know, but, you know, that was my first introduction to Islam was, you know, before I made Shahada, I made the fast across the Ramadan.
How did you end up in a mosque now? So we, the timeline, okay, Christian minister's son, from there, you weren't really into the teachings.
Agnostic, right. You know, I was comfortable calling myself an agnostic pagan for a while, and then...
Even you were calling yourself a Buddhist pagan?
Well, later.
Later?
Yeah.
Before we get to Islam, share with us that experience.
So I was with this sister. We were together for 17 years, and she's Buddhist and still practices, and she's followed a lot of different teachers over the years. But, you know, she's... you know, one of the, you know, one of the more spiritual people that I've ever met, and really beautiful woman in so many ways. And she taught me so much. And among the things that she taught me was how to meditate. And she took me to her teacher who taught me how to meditate. She would, you know, actively sought out teachers who were willing to teach me how to meditate. And, you know, I'd already been a vegetarian for since 1986. So, you know, it wasn't a big step for me to, you know, learn how to sit quietly and try to clear the thoughts out of my skull and focus on, you know. So then I was calling myself an agnostic pagan Buddhist. You know, I still had respect for the creation.
So now you were calling yourself a what? An agnostic?
Agnostic pagan Buddhist.
And, you were actually, that's what you were calling yourself.
When people would ask. You know, I wasn't out proselytizing. You know, my organizing was focused on political issues and on community issues. It wasn't on matters of faith.
Would people who practice Buddhism, would they take offense to that if you put that in front of Buddhism, that term?
You know, I suspect that there may be in the world people who count themselves as Buddhists who might take offense, but the Buddhists that I know didn't, you know, and the Buddhists that I knew weren't really asking me, you know, they practiced their faith, they lived their faith, you know, and some of them, I mean, I count among my friends, Buddhist monks and, Denise and Utsumi have, you know, built a dojo here in Atlanta, and I count them as dear friends, and I haven't seen them in a couple of years, but, you know, but I never experienced any Buddhists proselytizing to me and asking me about my own practice. They just live their practice, you know.
So how do you get to Islam now that you're actually in a mosque, a masjid, for iftar?
So I take this new job up in Alpharetta, and there was a brother there named Miraj who and I tell him, you know, Miraj, it's all your fault. And when I introduce Miraj to my friends and in the local Muslim community who he may not previously know, I said, you know, it's his fault that that you're stuck with me now. But I had just started this job, and, you know, a few weeks or a month or so later, he comes and shares this flyer with me and says, we're doing an open house at our mosque. And we'd love to have you come, and, you know, we'll have a little food, and, you know, there'll be a little talk, and you'll get to meet some of our neighbors, and, you know, please come. And, you know, this was long before I knew what dawah was or what it meant or whatever, but it was a dawah event, a bit, essentially. And there's this... is it the Furqan Institute, I believe? And there's this brother out of North Carolina named Imam Issa who drove down to be with us in North Fulton at the Hamza Islamic Center. And I drove out there, and Imam Issa had all these posters on the wall, and basically it was debunking the myths of Islam, you know, as we understand it. And to me, you know, it started as a political project that, you know, I'm a political organizer. I've been organizing against war since the 1970s or 80s. Well, certainly since the mid or late 80s, I've been actively organizing in communities in opposition to war. And, I knew that for whatever reason, most of the people that seemed to be under the bombs and the drones and the artillery shelling and the small arms fire of paid for with my nation's tax dollars seemed to be Muslim. I didn't quite know why. You know, I had not really, well, I say I hadn't really dealt with Muslims before, but the reality is that once I entered the Muslim community, I started realizing how many Muslims I had always dealt with in my own circle of people. I just never connected them with Islam or with the Muslim community. And, you know, and they had all these wonderful Arabic names, and some of them wore kufis, and you know, and all these different signs that were there to be seen. I just wasn't looking for them, and so I didn't realize that I had been knowing Muslims all my life, or all my adult life. But you know, at the time, you know, it was a political project, you know, a piece of political education. I accepted his invitation to go out there and realize what I already knew is that, you know, it's the same heart underneath the skin, you know, no matter, you know, how you make prayer on whatever day you consider the Sabbath, that we're all one, right? And so I go to this, I go out to this masjid in Alpharetta, or the town just north of Alpharetta, whose name I'm skipping. I'm at Hamza, and, you know, he's walking around the walls of the masjid, and at every place where we stop, he explains some word or some concept, or, you know, and links to and debunks some myths and says, you know, you'll hear in the media this, but in reality, it's more like that. And, you know, and he, in an hour or so, he gave this presentation, and I went back, and you know, and they handed me a Quran on the way out the door, and they told me not to read it on the toilet, and I said, but that's where I do all my reading, you know. So it's set up on a shelf, you know, unread, but I decided as a result or inspired by that I would try the fast. And so one day I walked over to Mirage's desk, tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, would you give me a heads up? Just let me know when y'all start fasting. Because we were, you know, just a few days, I was kind of keeping track of the calendar. But we were a few days out from Ramadan, but I knew that, you know, it was all about the local moon sighting, although apparently a lot of folks are following Saudi Arabia on that. But that, you know, some people thought the fast would begin on this day, other people thought the fast would begin on another day. And so I said, just let me know when y'all begin fasting, if you would, please. And so he did. And on that day, I began fasting. And we were like maybe a week into Ramadan before he realized that I was fasting too. And you know, he was all excited, mashallah, and whatever. And he said, well, if you're going to fast with us, you have to come enjoy the iftar celebration with us as well. And I said, what's an iftar celebration? And he said, be here at, come back to the masjid at this hour. And so he got me there, you know, a few minutes before Maghrib, and they started they were handing me dates and a bottle of water as I walked through the door. And I said, okay, I could go with dates. I enjoy dates. And everyone made salah, and you know, I sat in the back and meditated for 10 minutes like the Buddhist taught me, and you know, tried to stay out of people's way, and then everyone was lining up for this potluck in the back, and you know, it was really uncomfortable. Everyone kept trying to tell me that I could sit down. They would bring me food, and they went to the front of the line and they brought me food and tried to hand it to me. And I said, you know, really, I'm in this conversation here with these folks in line, and I'm really enjoy getting to know people. You don't have to feed me. It's all good. I'm willing to be patient. I've waited all day to eat. I could wait a few more minutes till I get to the front of the line of my own accord. And so I continued the conversation with the brothers there, and we got to the front of the line, and, you know, I was grateful that they had vegetarian options, and the food was exquisite. It was, you know, it's mostly a South Asian community at Hamza, and I've always been fond of Indian and Pakistani food, and, you know, so that was really comfortable for me. And afterwards, people lined up for Isha, and I went back and sat in the back and meditated like the Buddhists had taught me. And and then they lined up for I'm flaking on the name of it. The prayer you stand for prayer after the
Tarawih.
Yeah, and night so prayer, they, yeah. Right, and you know I would slip out after a few rakat, and I didn't know to call them rakat at the time, but I'd go home and get a little sleep and get ready for work the next day. You know, and so one day I'm standing in line there during the iftar, and they ask, you know, and he looked at me kind of incredulously, "You mean you're not Muslim?" I said, "No, sir." "Well, what are you?" "Well, you know, I had the rap down. You know, I'm probably more like a, I don't know, maybe an agnostic pagan Buddhist." And he said, "Mashallah, you're in the perfect place." And so, you know, I made it not every night, but I started making the iftars out at with the brothers out at Humza, you know, several nights a week. And every night I would sit in the back during the salah and meditate like they taught me to do as a Buddhist. And then it came to be Eid. And I kept trying to be in the back, but, you know, they rented this giant banquet hall, and it kept filling up and getting tighter and tighter, and there was no place for me to spread out my knees and meditate like they taught me to do as a Buddhist. And so for the first time, I found myself making salah as if I were a Muslim. I hadn't made shahada or nothing. I just, you know, and but, you know, I took on the practices one by one. Okay, well, I'll go to a dawah. Okay, I'll try a fast. Okay, well, look at that. I made four rakah, even though I didn't have a clue what I was doing there. And, you know, it'd be another – it was in the coming year that, you know, I finally – Mirage was on vacation at the time. But there was another Muslim brother there in our office, and we had – we would get one of the conference rooms for Dor and Asr. Mirage comes back from India, where he'd been visiting family, and he comes in, and in the meantime, I had learned to make a comma. The other brother had insisted.
So you already learned how to make the
After that first fast, yeah.
But you learned how to make this the call to prayer before you actually accepted Islam, took the shahada?
Indeed, yes. And so I was making a comma, and you know, Owen turned around and told me to make a comma, and Mirage, you know, gave me this quizzical look. And so I started making it. And as soon as I got through Rasulullah, he interrupted and said, "Mashallah, you know, you just made shahada." And he had always promised that, you know, that once he made shahada, that, you know, his wife would be happy to help arrange for a bride for me to marry. And I you say, whoa, slow down, you know. And but and I said, can we get back to it? And, you know, because I got to, you know, finish this prayer and get back to work. And I got some deadline or another, whatever, at work. And so we went through the prayer, but Mirage was so ecstatic. It's kind of funny. But, yeah, that was my first year, yeah.
Wow. So any regrets?
We're still making war all over the planet. I can't figure out why. Women are still not safe in their homes. I wish it were different. Yeah, I got regrets, but, you know, not about my spiritual path.
Tell us, we're almost out of time now.
Sure.
We're just get your advice for those people who are out there and they have, like so many, are hypnotized by the media, and this helps to just nurture and foster this hate towards Islam. Mm-hmm. Now you're a Muslim. I mean, what kind of impression, what were your thoughts about Islam before you accepted it? And now for those people who have these kind of negative stereotypes, you being a Muslim now, an American, come from a Christian background, what would you say to those type of people out there?
Well, in terms of what I understood about Muslims before was that they were demonized by a media that I didn't trust. You know, this is the same media that seemed to want to justify killing people, and you know, it never added up. Was didn't sound like a very Christian thing to do, although I was told we were a Christian nation and we had to do this in the name of Christianity. Some people would even go so far as to say, we have to go kill these people in the name of Christianity. You know, Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, whatever you call him, he had this poem he wrote, or not, a short story called The War Prayer, where, and I don't remember the details of it, but it was basically this pastor ascends the pulpit and offers a prayer for our side's victory in a war. This, I think, may have been inspired by the U.S. war to occupy Mexico and to extend the institution of slavery into Texas and south of the Rio Grande, or maybe it was the Civil War. I don't remember exactly when he wrote this piece, but you know, and it always struck me the hypocrisy, you know, right there in the commandments that Musa be, may peace be upon him, is told, we are told what brought down on the tablets, you know, that thou shalt not kill, except when we say that it's, you know, the Christian thing to do, apparently. But you know, it tore my stomach up when Daddy Bush started his war against Iraq. And it did it again when his son did it again. And, you know, in the meantime, in the interim, we had, what's the dude's name, Clinton from Arkansas, was making war against the people in Serbia and Croatia. And I had no idea what that was about, you know, but none of it seemed right. And then, you know, I watch a couple of planes fly into buildings and office buildings one day, and suddenly we're supposed to hate Afghanis and go to war against their people and destroy their land. And I was kept trying to figure out, but what does that have to do with this foolishness? You know, it's clear that this was an inside job. You don't get three planes flying into office buildings without some sort of inside collusion. Let's be real about this. What's this got to do with Afghanistan? But it seemed, you know, perfectly reasonable, and everyone around me thought it was perfectly reasonable to go kill children in Afghanistan for some reason. You know, and you know, of course, the federal territories on the northern border, you know, who knows where the border between Afghanistan and Pakistan is, you know, well, they're all brown folks anyway, it's okay to kill them. And none of this added up. And, you know, I was organizing anyone I could find who was opposed to it to take action against it in any way that we could figure out how to take action and to be visible in our opposition to the war. And you know, so the media told me it was okay for us to go kill people. And now the media was telling us it was okay to, you know, to be fearful of or hateful towards or wage war against the Muslim world. That didn't make any more sense to me than, you know, any of the rest of it. And but, you know, the community is just as loving in our massages as it is in any church, Christian church community I've ever been. And the food is generally better and healthier. And at least, you know, at least out this way among the Asian community. And you know, they tend to have a more learned perspective on the world and be less insular. You know, I get exposed to more cultures and more perspectives and more more perspectives on how the world operates. And because at least, you know, and it doesn't matter. I've attended the prayers in masjids in three different states now, or massages in three different states. And wherever I go, you know, I line up in the ranks and I'm instantly welcomed. And, you know, there's this sense of community and brotherhood there. And, you know, I'm told that, and of course, that's probably available in most any faith that is, you know, really about building community and building support for one another. But I also find that the Muslim community seems to be a lot less insular. You know, the free medical clinics that we put up are not just for the members of the congregation. You know, it's when we feed the hungry, it's like everyone who's hungry, not just the people who come and pray with us. You know, when we respond to the storms and the disasters, you know, no one's asking you whether you made shahada or you know, if you're keeping the prayers or you know, are you one of those dreaded agnostic pagan Buddhists? You know, it's mashallah, you're in the perfect place. How wonderful it is to have you here. You know, it's a lived faith, mm-hmm. You know. It's a lived faith that is exhibited in how people treat one another. You know, they say a Muslim is someone who is safe from the words and the from the hands and the tongue of his fellow Muslim.
We want to thank you, Huesco, for sharing your story with us. God willing, inshallah, this can inspire so many more people out there who have so many misconceptions about Islam. They can be motivated to read the Quran, to go visit a mosque for maybe iftar like you did. Yeah, so thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm looking forward to the next opportunity to be with you.
Inshallah, me too. Thank you very much.
Inshallah.
And thank you guys for tuning in. Like I said, we're not just telling a story. We're inspiring people, helping to change lives for the better. And hopefully this story can resonate with you so it will motivate you to go ahead and look in to the most misunderstood way of life. Yes, it's the fastest growing way of life in the world, Islam, submission to the creator, not the creation, the same God that Jesus, Moses, Abraham, and the last and final messenger said to mankind, the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, worship, living the true purpose of life and why you've been created. Thank you very much. We'll see you next time. Peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.